Welcome to the Public Morality. Back in August 2019, the New York Times Magazine published the 1619 Project. The long-form journalism project sought to reframe the nation's history by illustrating the consequences of slavery and the contributions of black people at the very center of the American narrative. The original printing consisted of 100 pages, 10 essays, a photo essay, along with a collection of poems and additional stories. Multiple writers, through their unique lenses, addressed the impact of slavery that began in 1619 into the present day. It was popular, evidenced not only by the initial sales, but also by the demands for reprinting. It was also controversial, evidenced by the number of factual errors contained, particularly in its creator, Nicole Hannah Jones's initial piece. A number of historians sympathetic to the project's mission took out an open letter denoting the inaccuracies of the 1619 Project. Since its initial publishing, the 1619 Project has been a proverbial lightning rod for conservative opposition. The original printing, along with the reprinting, has created a demand that is now in the form of a brand new book. To discuss the 1619 Project is Damon Linker. Linker is a contributing editor for The New Republic and is a senior writing fellow in the Center for Critical Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. He penned an essay recently in This Week entitled The Model at the Middle of the 1619 Project. Damon Linker, welcome to The Public Morality.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a great honor to be here.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons we wanted to have you on, your piece in The Week offered, in my estimation, judicious criticisms of the 1619 Project on the merits. You did not seem to, as I found other pieces to do, was to conflate the project with the entire essay provided by Nicole Hannah Jones, nor did you offer the 1619 Project as some sort of extension of critical race theory. That said, let's begin by having you offer a brief distillation of how you view the 1619 Project.
Yeah, well, I mean, in my view, the thing that I find troubling or worthy of critical reflection in the project has to do mostly with the framing of it rather than that much of its content. And I wrote the column to sort of point to what I see as a kind of a tension or a contradiction in how the project is framed, even by the people putting it forth, whether it's Nicole Hannah Jones or Silverstein.
Yeah, but Silverstein, yes.
Yes, because he wrote a very interesting, long historiographical essay in the Times Magazine a little over a week ago in which he reflected on the project. And I think I saw the same contradiction or tension there. And that has to do with, is the 1619 Project supposed to be increasing our awareness of the complexity, the moral tensions and contradictions in American history so that we understand those contradictions and tensions and nuances better and more adequately? Or is it instead trying to replace an overly simplified sort of default conservative nationalist view of America, an overly, maybe you could say, uncritically patriotic vision of the country? Is it trying to replace that with a kind of counter narrative where slavery and its horrible racist legacy is at the very center of what it means to be an American? And I think the rhetoric surrounding the project in its what journalists call the display copy, meaning like headlines, subheadlines, photo captions, poll quotes within essays. In the original 1619 Project, That material very much went to the more, I think, radical option of saying this is about the true founding of America. It's not 1603 when the first settlers arrived, white settlers arrived in Virginia. It's not when the Puritans made landfall in Plymouth Rock. No, it's 1619, the year that the first slaves arrived from Africa on ships. That's the quote, true founding of America. Now, my view is that talking in terms of any one date being the founding of America is always going to be a simplification. And you don't replace the oversimplification of the kind of pious homiletical view of American history with an alternative counter homily that actually seeks to place one of the worst things about American history at the very core of what it means to be an American. And I think both intellectually and politically, this was a mistake. Now, journalistically, it might have been great because it got tons of traffic and it got people yelling and it got everybody screaming about the 1619 Project. Great for publicity to give it that more radical spin. But again, as an intellectual proposition and as a political proposition, which then I think gives the right wing a kind of ammunition to attack what the 1619 Project was all about in its substance, I think it was not a great idea. And I would be in favor of a much more complex view of history and of the project to say what 1619 is here to do is to help all of us, black, white, whatever, try to understand that our country is a complicated, complex, morally fraught exercise and enterprise that combines admirable things with execrable things, and then lots of stuff in the gray middle.
You mentioned the way that the project has been attacked by, say, the conservative side of the ledger. Why do you suppose there has been so much clamor about the project, both in support and as well as in opposition?
We're really dealing with differences of opinion about what history is for. Is history the study of the past, especially if it's political history, the history of a country told by people in that country? That would be us. So we're Americans talking about our own history as Americans. Is the point of that to provide a kind of useful political civic religion for us, kind of a sort of account of who we are that is useful politically, and to kind of galvanize our identity as citizens of this polity? Is that the view of it? Or is it the way, I think, in its best sense, professional historians look at it, scholars who are trained in doctoral programs to be historians and go to archives and sort through the kind of the fine-grained detail of the past? For that view of history, it often involves almost the diametric opposite. It involves, again, the process of complexification, of seeing how multidimensional the past is. There's so many actors. They're also they're the people who have power, the people who lack power at various gradations. They're different ethnic groups, races, immigrants coming in at all different times, and so forth. And you can just multiply this by more and more complexity the more you look at it more closely. I do think In a lot of the details of the very good essays that were in the original 1619 Project package in the Times Magazine, lots of material for that complexification process, lots of good stuff from the latest cutting edge research by professional historians. But then it was placed in a frame that sort of took on that first view of history, the more political version of history, where history is there to be studied for the sake of its civic usefulness. And that form of history is often a more simple view of like America is exceptional, both in the sense of unique and in the sense of really, really great, maybe the best country ever. And that's what more conservative type political actors look at history for. But then the 1619 Project seemed to be framed as like trying to overthrow that, not in favor of complexity, but in favor of a counter narrative for the sake of sort of moving a left-wing progressive narrative to the center, meaning, and not political center, but kind of to the middle of our conversation. So we would replace the overly simplified American exceptionalist narrative with one that points out, tries to claim that slavery is the core of what it means to be an American. Its legacy defines the essence of the nation. It shaped capitalism at its core. It shapes transportation policy, where we build highways, where you can live, our economy, our culture, and all of these ways sort of interweaving racial oppression through everything. And that, I think, while there is a lot of truth to racial oppression being present in those aspects of America, it still is not the core. It is not the center. And the reason why is, I think, in the end, that there, strictly speaking, is no center to what is basically a continent-wide civilization that's been going on for about 400 years. And it is always, again, intellectually deceptive to talk in terms of anything being the center of something that complicated. I mean, I mentioned in passing immigrants. I mean, it's not clear to me how the 1619 Project outlook in this more radical framing of it can really account for the fact of waves of millions of immigrants coming in from Ireland and Italy and Jewish Eastern Europe and then Asia, Chinese, Japanese immigrants, now in our last several decades from Mexico. And of course, the Mexican influence on the border states long before there was official immigration, because those states were taken from Mexico in the first place. And there was a lot of blending of those cultures. Those are really important parts of America. They're not the center either, but the 1619 Project can't really say much about those aspects of America because they are sort of peripheral to slavery and its legacy. You see what I mean? Like that's what I mean about don't overstate, don't turn the criticism of the simplifications of the conservatives into a kind of counter story, an alternative simplification for the sake of a progressive agenda. It's replacing one defect with a different kind of opposite defect, at least in my outlook on it.
And that list that you just gave, I would also add in there, westward expansion and the appropriation of Native American lands. There's very little discussed about the impact on Native Americans in the westward expansion and the creation of a morality in the context of manifest destiny to justify that appropriation.
Absolutely. And that whole rhetoric of manifest destiny and appropriation justified theological appropriation of it, because this was all very much wrapped up with and still is today in kind of resonances with a sort of theological predestination that we are, the America is the new Israel and God is on our side and he intends this land to be ours from the East Coast all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and in our acts along the way and the injustices that we engage in along the way, God still favors us in this. This is our destiny, just like the ancient Israelites were destined for its multi-millennial project on the surface of the earth, because they were God's chosen people. It's the Lincoln's famous line about how America is an almost chosen nation is a gesture toward trying to acknowledge that very deep strand in American history that goes back to the Puritans and then gets kind of reinvented and reinjected into our rhetoric over and over again. And frankly, I think the 1776 commission that Trump launched as a direct challenge to the 1619 project is the most recent kind of rebirth of this very old, theologically tinged way of trying to understand America. And I'm very much a critic of that as well. And I write at least as many columns critical of Trump and what's become of the American right as I do about what I see as some of the excesses of the progressive side as well, because I see them trying to revive the simplification for the sake of the right.
Well, we several months ago, we had a historian, Gordon Wood, on the broadcast, and I can assure you that Professor Wood shares that observation, your latter observation. You know, one of the things that I recall when sort of the clamor first came out about the 1619 Project, in the retreat, I believe it was Nicole Hannah Jones that said, well, I'm not a historian, you know, I'm a journalist. Does that suffice?
Well, I mean, if she's talking about the specific historical inaccuracy that was in her original essay, then, you know, I guess then you issue a correction and say, oh, in this passage, I overstated this. You include, I guess they made a change of adding some people or something. She made a very strong statement that those who supported the American Revolution were doing it to defend slavery. And a lot of historians, Gordon Wood, among others, rose up to say this is not historically accurate. So online, you can always just update the text. So the original printed version can't be corrected, but online it now says some people or some of the people who supported the revolution. If that's the case, I do think it's acceptable to say, yeah, all right, I flubbed something. I'm not a trained historian. I read history a lot as a journalist, but I made a mistake. Sorry. And that's fine. That journalists do make mistakes, even when history has nothing to do with it. And that happens. But in general, I think it's perfectly fine for intellectuals, journalists, laymen and laywomen to simply read history and to talk about it and to even make very strong political arguments on the basis of their study of that. That's totally, you know, to deny the ability to do that is to I think try to stifle debate in a free society, and I would never make that case.
I'm speaking with writer David Linkler, who wrote a very persuasive piece on The Week. That's why we wanted to have him on, The Public Morality. And Damon, you know, I guess one of the subtexts from your piece that I took away is sort of this ongoing question, who gets to tell the American narrative? And I wonder how you saw that question.
Well, I mean, at one level, I would say we all do, because simply by engaging in politics, we make references to a kind of common world that we all share. And that world has a past, and that past resonates and echoes throughout that present world. And also, you know, in engaging in politics, we're always talking about the future that we'd like to see. And that is itself informed by our present, which is informed by the past. So there's no getting around those kinds of amateur historical statements. And I don't mean amateur in a condescending way either. I mean it in the original kind of the original etymological sense of someone who is doing something out of love. In that sense, it would be love of our common world together. So I have no problem with that. I do think, though, that as with so many things in our modern world, there's a lot of knowledge going on, and there are people in our world who are trained to be historians, and they do the hard work of actually looking at the real historical record rather than the sort of idealized version of it that gets handed down and often talked about in our common world. So I would counsel, I guess, like, yes, by all means, talk about our common history, but as a rule of thumb, defer to the people who sort of know what they're talking about. I mean, I very much appreciate Nicole's work, also Jamel Bowie at the Times, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and many people writing on these topics who actually are not trained historians, but who nevertheless read a lot of history and let that history inform what they say about it. I would much rather read, say, an opinion column on these subjects, even if I don't agree with the kind of the political angle entirely, if it shows that it's based on a rich and deep reading of the latest history. That's a very good contribution to public debate, and we need more of that. And that's part of what it means to be a thinker and an engaged citizen, is to realize that we're all trying to figure it out, and it's all a conversation that never ends. There's never any full agreement about anything.
Well, you know, I was just thinking when you were giving that last answer, I referenced this book last week, but Cornell professor Edward Baptist, the title of his book, The Half Has Not Been Told. Well, that title, you know, comes from a slave articulating from the slave narratives during the Roosevelt administration. And he says the half has not been told. So the perspective of the former enslaved is a different one than the plantation owner. So there's a perspective to all of this that we can all see the same thing. But doesn't perspective hone our understanding of history as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's been a huge advance. I mean, one great thing about Jake Silverstein's essay in the Times Magazine that I referenced earlier, shortly after, you know, I forgot his name for a moment. His piece was actually an excellent overview. I'd recommend that your listeners take a look at it. A really good overview of American historiography, which is kind of, it's a complicated, highfalutin sounding word that just means the history of history. It's the history of how history has been written in a given subject area. And it was an overview of how Americans have told history. And it is in effect a story of how history has moved from my one category of the more simplified, homiletical, patriotic version of history to a more complex, nuanced one. And it isn't just that we've looked at more archives, it's that we've also looked down. So history, even, you know, history, say 100 years ago, could be very well done, but it would only be looking at the elite white leaders of America. So the original constitutional framers and the generation of them who then became the first presidents, and then the Jacksonian Revolution and the people in charge of the political system then leading up to the Civil War and Lincoln. And you would basically be talking about elites. And then if you did more cultural history, you would look at theologians and writers and so forth. And that stuff's all great. I mean, I like that kind of history quite a lot, and it's still done well today by some people, intellectual and cultural and political history, but the what Silverstein's essay in the Times Magazine was very good at is showing how this had huge impact on how we understood the history of Black Americans, because aside from an occasional, like a Frederick Douglass, there were essentially no elites for a very long time in American history who were Black. And so you were not getting their side of the story. And so we not only kind of history has not only improved by looking more closely and carefully at archival sources, but also by turning our gaze sort of downward in the socioeconomic hierarchy to slaves and their descendants and freed Blacks who weren't slaves and lived maybe in New England, and they made contributions and yet were also moved to the periphery of American life. And then that peripheral move ends up echoed in the early history written of those times. So we need to go back and do that work. And that's been a huge boon for the study of the past. Our understanding of what it meant to be an American in past eras is vastly improved by having made that shift.
Here's a passage from the piece that you wrote, and I'll follow up with a question, but you wrote, quote, "The broader objection concerned the sweeping language," and sweeping language being what you talked earlier about, this sort of oversimplification, "which could be found throughout the package and which played an especially prominent part in one essay by sociologist Matthew Desmond, focused on supposedly decisive influence of slavery on the distinctive brutality of American capitalism," unquote. Now, the thinking of slavery ensnares sociology, politics, and certainly racism, but the overarching motivation, as I saw it, is sort of the amorality fueled by the demands of capitalism. And wasn't that the subtext of Desmond's article, that the distinctive brutality of America's fueled by sort of these amoral impulses that are demanded by capitalism?
Well, this is a complicated subject, and I'm not an economist, although you mentioned Ed Baptist. He's one of several younger historians who've sort of launched a subfield of American history called the history of capitalism. And as a pluralist, a kind of liberal pluralist, I am all in favor of new contributions to historical knowledge and new ways of looking at things. I'm even willing to defend exaggerations that are there deliberately to sort of rewrite the balance. So if things are too tilted in one direction, sometimes you can make a pretty big leap in historical knowledge by kind of overstating your case on the other side, precisely to kind of upset the settled consensus. And I would say that there is some value to the history of capitalism literature on those grounds. I would say, though, that I do think it's overstated, and I would point to there have been scholarly critiques of some of this literature pointing out that it goes a little bit far in trying to claim the decisive importance of slavery for why American capitalism takes the form that it does. For me, one decisive concern I have about it is the very fact that the Industrial Revolution, which is really where modern capitalism kind of comes into its own as a distinctive form of kind of highly advanced division of labor, arises in Europe before it does in our country, and is plenty severe and plenty brutal. And it really didn't have much directly to do with slavery at all. And so the argument ends up coming down to, I believe, the way that this literature in American history now tries to show that the way slaves were bought and sold and traded, and the bookkeeping methods that were used to describe the value of individual slaves to the slave owners, and then the way that cotton plantations ended up being organized, and cotton sales ended up being structured economically because of slavery. Is that's what led to the development of capitalism in the way that it did in this country? And I simply, I just, that strikes me as an overstatement. I mean, in addition to the comparison to Europe and the rise, especially in Great Britain, of advanced industrial capitalism before and just as viciously as here, you also have the fact that the North is actually industrialized before the South. And again, you can say that slavery might have some influence on that, but that, of course, was not the region in which slavery was by far the more dominant social institution and economic institution. So it just strikes me as an attempt to, again, I will concede that maybe they are, this literature is highlighting aspects of capitalism that it would be good to focus on because they've been neglected. But I would venture to say that probably over the next generation or two of scholarship, we will see some of the claims in that literature pulled back a little bit and rendered with a little bit more nuance than that literature in its initial offering tended to do. I think it's an overstatement.
You also wrote, quote, "No professionally trained historian writing in good faith about the American past in 2021 would dispute that Black history is a critically important aspect of American history," unquote. Isn't that part of the challenge that what we're calling, quote unquote, Black history, as well as other marginalized histories, are treated, my words, with a sort of an adjunct status rather than part of the American narrative?
I do think that that is a problem, and I would very much be on the side of those who want it, who would say I'm in favor of integrating it more. I actually, as a liberal, as opposed to a progressive or conservative on either side, I'm very much, would very much prefer that the history of Black America be integrated into the history of America rather than the way, and I understand kind of in structural terms why it's developed this way in the modern university, because it's a bureaucratic institution. And so, like, it makes sense to create like a Department of Afro-American Studies if there aren't a lot of slots in the extant history department for people to who will do that. So say there are only two openings over a couple of years in the history department, it might make sense to just set up a separate department just for people to study that rather than to wait two decades for there to be several openings in history and for every hire in the history department to be in that. That can be destabilizing in its own way. So it makes a kind of sense, but it is not ideal for there to be departments of Afro-American studies, Latino-American studies, gender studies, you know, all of these, the studies. I think hopefully, I don't know if I'm hopeful enough to believe it will really happen, but ideally we would move toward a new synthesis where history departments study all of that stuff under the rubric of American history, because that's what American history is. We are a motley band of, Joseph's Technicolor dream coat of a country. We're like made up of a million pieces and swatches. And it's important that the story of everything we tell have those elements within it. We study, say, you know, and this kind of simplification happens in our politics all the time. You know, we study, where are we in favor of, minority rights? Yes. But then you drill down and you realize that actually, like, you know, Hispanic Americans and Black Americans don't agree about a lot. And Black Americans, actually, there are a lot more militant younger Blacks who are kind of more on the further progressive left. But then lots of maybe often a little older black Americans are actually more moderate and supported Joe Biden and want more money for funding police. And then you got the defund police on the left. Then among Hispanics, you have huge divergences and disagreements among Hispanics over, the one big thing in the political news over the last year has been that, Latinos who don't have college degrees are drifting rightward, and sort of more of them are voting for Trump, not a majority, but enough to maybe make a difference in our very close presidential elections in this country. And you also have the difference that, like, when Bernie Sanders ran for president, he did incredibly well in the Latino population in California, but not very well at all in that same population in Texas. That points to a very different kind of Hispanic population, different core of concerns and so forth. So I could go on and on, but you get the point. The point is, yes, we're complicated and we need to bring the complication toward the center. And that creates a center that really isn't a proper center. It's a kind of constellation of perspectives that needs to be in conversation with itself.
Things fall apart for which the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Is that the new American narrative?
Maybe so. Maybe so. I like to think in my naivete that we could get a new story that incorporates all of that in an appreciation of our complexity and what we do share, which is, isn't it true that everybody believes in liberty? We disagree about what liberty consists in and how to get it, but we want to be free and equal in our freedom. If you say that to almost any American, even if they disagree pretty profoundly about what it means, we probably can affirm that as an ideal, and that's something to build on, yeah. I think.
Well, hopefully we will all take a page from Zechariah 9 and all become prisoners of hope. Damon Linker, thank you so much, sir, for joining me today on The Public Morality.
And thanks for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
That was Damon Linker. Stay tuned as I speak with law professor John Gross about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse case. That's coming up on The Public Morality. Welcome back. Depending on where one sat on America's political continuum, they were either elated or bewildered that Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty for killing two individuals and injuring a third during the 2020 demonstration for a police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Rittenhouse, then 17, traveled some 33 miles from his home in Antioch, Illinois, to Kenosha. Rittenhouse claimed self-defense, and a jury of his peers agreed. My guest, University of Wisconsin law professor John Gross, wrote an op-ed for the Wisconsin State Journal that he felt Rittenhouse, prior to the decision, would be exonerated largely because of the way the law for self-defense was written in the state of Wisconsin. John Gross, welcome to The Public Morality.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.
Now, in the introduction, I stated that you wrote prior to the actual verdict that you felt if the jury applied the law of self-defense as it is written in the state of Wisconsin, there would be a good chance that Kyle Rittenhouse would have been vindicated, which turned out to be the case. What was it in the law specifically that made you feel that way?
Well, we all knew the facts of this case. The coverage of the case and the reports that sort of reconstructed the events of that night, where the shootings occurred, the video that we all watched. So we knew what the defense was going to be. And if you raise the issue of self-defense in Wisconsin, which Mr. Rittenhouse was definitely going to raise this as an issue, the prosecution has to prove to the jury that you did not act in self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a very high burden for them. And with all of the chaos that was happening around Mr. Rittenhouse and under all of those circumstances that we were able to see, I just didn't feel like the prosecution was going to be able to meet that burden.
Now, when you say that's a high bar, is that a high bar for Wisconsin, or is that a high bar in just legally speaking in general?
It's a high bar legally speaking in general, and pretty much all of the states, or almost all states, follow this same rule, that if the defendant raises the issue, then the prosecution has to disprove it. And that has been the law for a really long time in the U.S., in the majority of jurisdictions, and there's a good reason for that. The good reason is you can imagine a scenario where, let's say, someone is the victim of domestic abuse, and they wind up shooting or stabbing their significant other, their spouse, and claim that they were about to be seriously harmed. Well, nobody has video of that. There are no witnesses to that, unlike Mr. Rittenhouse's case. And so do we want to make sure that the prosecution can prove that the person was not acting in self-defense in that scenario? We sure do. We don't want to send an innocent person to jail. So Mr. Rittenhouse's case, because it was unique in many ways, because of the surrounding facts and circumstances, it created a situation where that standard, which normally makes a lot of sense, felt to a lot of people like it no longer made sense.
One of the things I sort of joke about, that before any legal proceedings, there's always the initial trial is always the one held in the court of public opinion, where there's no burden to attend law school or pass the bar, unless you're talking about your local tavern. That said, I want to run some of the bullets by you that dominated the conversation. I would like to have you tell me, in terms of legally speaking, why these were not accurate. One of the arguments we heard often was that he was not legally allowed to possess a gun that he used to kill two people and seriously injure a third. How did that factor into this ruling?
Well, I think it definitely factored into people's opinion of the case, because it was widely reported that he was not permitted to have the gun, that his possession of the gun was in fact illegal under Wisconsin law. The prosecution charged him with that. They charged him as being in possession of a firearm under the age of 18, and it looked certainly like they were going to get a conviction on that. Up until the point when the judge in the case decided that the way the law was written in Wisconsin, it was actually not applicable to him. And so that charge wound up being dismissed. But I think the idea that he was possessing this illegal firearm, definitely, I think, as you say, in the court of public opinion, that was a fact that strongly suggested he should be convicted of more serious crimes because he had a gun that he wasn't allowed to have.
How about the fact that he was in Kenosha at a time when the curfew was already in place?
Again, I think that factors into people's view of the reasonableness of his actions overall. He's carrying a weapon he's not allowed to have. He's in downtown Kenosha, and he's not allowed to be there. And for some folks, that's enough, right? It's enough to say he's carrying an assault-style weapon, an AR-15. That is illegal for him to have, and he's now in a place where it is illegal for him to be because of this curfew order. And so can he claim the privilege of self-defense? And for most people, they were thinking no, he shouldn't be allowed to.
And then finally, there was the one that just the mere fact that he is carrying an AR-15 assault rifle in the midst of a demonstration that's already a powder keg, if you would, in public, puts others on alarm, and so any attempts to disarm him would seem justified based on the fact that he was in a position to use deadly force. Did that factor in at all?
I mean, this is an area of the law where I think people should really evaluate whether or not these types of open carry laws that have become increasingly popular in states make sense. Because, you know, it's not just that he's carrying a gun. He's carrying a rifle with, you know, that is commonly used in mass shootings. He has it strapped to his chest. To a lot of people, that in and of itself is provocative, and they may look at someone like that who's carrying that type of weapon in the way that he's carrying it and think to themselves, I feel unsafe. I'm the one whose life may be under threat. And so even though I don't have a weapon myself, I want to disarm this person. And so it's a reasonable thing for people to feel, but with open carry laws, and Wisconsin is an open carry state, the law is telling people, well, you're not supposed to be alarmed about someone openly carrying a weapon like that. But I think that's inconsistent with the way many of us feel. And in a situation like this, it's inconsistent with common sense.
Now, in the case of the Wisconsin self-defense law, is there a duty to retreat?
There is not an explicit duty to retreat. Many states do have a duty to retreat. It is a very old rule that goes all the way back to England and the common law, the only exception being when you're in your home. That's when you don't have a duty to retreat. And again, states have increasingly been adopting these stand your ground laws, which say you don't have to retreat before using deadly force. Wisconsin does not have a duty to retreat, but they also do not have a stand your ground law. Wisconsin law just says that the use of force overall has to be reasonable. And as part of the evaluation of whether or not it was reasonable, the jury can consider whether or not the defendant had an option to retreat. So Wisconsin is sort of in the middle here in terms of the duty to retreat versus stand your ground.
I'm sorry, if you could just, I'm assuming that I'm not alone. Could you just explain the difference between stand your ground and the duty to retreat?
So a stand your ground law says that if I am under a threat, if somebody is threatening me with serious physical violence that will result in harm or death, and I am armed, I have the right to use deadly force against them, and the jury is not allowed to consider whether I had the duty to retreat. So if somebody is confronting me on the street with a knife and threatening to stab me, and I pull out a gun and immediately shoot them, right? The jury is not allowed in a state that has a stand your ground law to say, well, that wasn't a reasonable use of self-defense, because you could have tried to back away from the person with the knife. You could have tried to leave the area. So with states who have those types of laws, they're giving people an opportunity, and I hate to say it that way, but it really is, they're creating an opportunity for people to use deadly force when most of us, I think, would say it wasn't necessary for them to take a life.
Now, it's understandable that many critiquing the case, I'm not saying it's right, but it's understandable that people look at the outcome. And in this case, those who felt that Rittenhouse should have been guilty are displeased with the outcome, and those who obviously thought he should have been found not guilty were pleased. But one of the things I gathered from your piece, that a lot of the outcome of this case rested on laws passed by the Wisconsin legislature. Would that be accurate, sir?
Yes, yes. I mean, I think this case was, like I said, it was being driven really by this burden of proof that the prosecution has to disprove that the defendant was acting in self-defense.
Now, I realize this takes us away from matters of law into the realm of politics, but if we follow the logical conclusion of your response, we could just sort of rewind the Rittenhouse verdict, and it'll take us to not only the Wisconsin Republican majority, but the way that state has managed at the state level to gerrymander many districts that sort of cement a Republican majority.
I think it's true. I think, look, Wisconsin under the Republican legislature adopted both open carry and concealed carry. And prior to that, people who walked around with the type of weapon that Mr. Rittenhouse did that night in situations like the one he was in were typically, or at least could be, arrested by the police for disorderly conduct. that carrying a weapon of that type in a situation like that was likely to provoke a disturbance, which is what the disorderly conduct statute is designed for. People who do things which could create some type of public confrontation, disorder, or disruption can be arrested. The legislature specifically wrote into the disorderly conduct statute that it was not disorderly conduct to be walking around openly carrying firearms. And so there's a lot of blame to go around for what happened that night in Kenosha. Does some of that blame deservedly fall on a legislature that is willing to authorize behavior that I think many, if not most, people think is unreasonable because they want to send a message about being pro-gun? Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And so if officers had the power to arrest those folks who were walking around Kenosha that night carrying those weapons, if the officers could have gotten them off the street, would this tragedy have happened? Probably not. But under Wisconsin law, because open carry is okay, they were allowed to be there, and what happened happened.
And I know we're, our focus is primarily on the law, but I would just venture to say, if you and I were in Australia in the Great Barrier Reef, and for some reason I cut my wrist and I dove in the water and then got surrounded by great white sharks. I mean, I think part of you would say, well, Byron, you should not have dove into the Great Barrier Reef with while you're bleeding. I think one of the things that said, I think it's hard for people to grasp. I'd like to have you unpack it legally. That here's an individual who lives in a different state, drives, 33 miles from Antioch, Illinois to Kenosha. Why does that not have any bearing?
So when we talk about the law of self-defense, people aren't permitted to claim self-defense if they are the aggressors in a case, if they provoke the confrontation. And I think for a lot of people, looking at what Mr. Rittenhouse did, they view this as a provocation. As you said, he's coming from a different state. He's carrying with him a weapon that he thought, whatever the judge's final decision was about this, Mr. Rittenhouse himself said he did not think he could legally have that gun. And he's driving to a location where there's already a civil disruption in place, and there's already a lot of tension and the possibility for violence. And he's entering that situation when he doesn't need to, as a 17-year-old with this high-powered weapon. And people look at this and they say, isn't this enough of a provocation? Isn't he really the aggressor in this situation? The law focuses on what was the interaction between Mr. Rittenhouse and Mr. Rosenbaum, the person he shot, in the minutes, the seconds leading up to him pulling the trigger. And so he doesn't lose this argument about acting in self-defense just because he put himself into a position that most of us would look at and say, that was incredibly irresponsible to behave that way. And I understand people are struggling with that. People are struggling with that. And there's an expression that bad facts make bad law. And these are some really bad facts, and it leads to a legal result that most people feel is disappointing and doesn't really, for them, make them feel like the criminal justice system is working the way it should.
Hmm. Finally, based on your experience, is Mr. Rittenhouse in jeopardy at the federal level at all, or is this case done?
No, I really do think this case is done. Federal charges typically involve law enforcement, a state actor who commits some violation of civil rights that can subject you to a federal prosecution. But in this case, Mr. Rittenhouse is just a private citizen. And so I can't see a nexus to get him into federal court with any particular charge. I know some people have reported, you know, he crossed state lines with a gun. He actually didn't. The gun was actually stored in Wisconsin. So there doesn't seem to be any federal charge that would fit his situation. Hmm.
Professor John Gross, University of Wisconsin Law School, thank you so much, sir, for joining me today on the Public Morality. Much appreciated.
Happy to be here. Thanks so much.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, and SoundCloud. Those listening to the Public Morality on WSNC can now listen on its app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. And once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WGAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast the Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.